The Chain of Command, From 9/11 to Abu Ghraib, by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh, on Tuesday, May 10th at 5 p.m. in Folinger Auditorium on the south end of the U of I Quad. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we will explore the long-running conflict between conventional and alternative medicine, something that has been around at least since 1847, the year when the American Medical Association was organized. One of the things that we know nowadays is that there are a great many Americans that are interested in alternative medicine and have tried some sort of alternative therapy. And while it is true, we certainly should acknowledge the fact that there are some conventional physicians that are very open to the idea of alternatives. Generally speaking, the mainstream medical community views alternative medicine at least with a healthy dose of skepticism. The guest of our program this morning is Natalie Robbins, and she's the author of a recently published book that kind of is a case study looking at how this relationship between alternative and conventional medicine has played out over the years. Takes a look at the life and the career of a man named Royal Copeland, who was a physician. He also had a career in public health and in politics, and is probably more than any other single individual is responsible for championing homeopathic medicine here in the United States. We'll talk a little bit about him and about his career and about the issue very generally as we talk with Natalie Robbins. She's the author of 8 books, and this one that we're talking about here this morning is titled Copeland's Cure, Homeopathy and the War Between Conventional and Alternative Medicine. It's published by Knopf, and you could certainly find it out in the bookstore near you. Questions this morning here on the program are also welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Ms. Copeland, hello.
How do you do? Natalie Robbins.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Copeland.
It's okay.
Oh, man. Here's a guy who's on autopilot. Yes, Ms. Robbins. No relation to the man that you write
not
about.
Not that I
know
of, no.
Well, after tripping out of the starting gate, I'll say thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
And in the book, you explain that what you really set out to do, your interest was in writing about alternative medicine and this relationship between allopathic, the main what we call mainstream or conventional
right.
medicine and alternative. And in the beginning, you certainly didn't intend to write about Royal Copeland. And in fact, you said you didn't even know who Royal Copeland was when you started out.
Correct. A friend had suggested that I write about the, as she referred to it, as the war between alternative and traditional medicine. And as I began doing research, I came upon one of the more controversial alternative medicines, which is called homeopathy. And that led me to this man named Royal Copeland, who was basically a long forgotten person, but he was very important in leading homeopathy to where it is today, which is extremely popular. Close to 15 million Americans use the remedies. Royal Copeland was a doctor who was an eye surgeon. He studied at the University of Michigan homeopathic medical school, and at that time there were 2 separate schools, one for traditional doctors and one for homeopathic doctors, but they got the exact same training. And he eventually got tired of just being a practitioner, so he became a health commissioner of New York City during the flu pandemic of 1918 and eventually became a U.S. senator. He was a very unusual man. He was no ordinary doctor. He had a great deal of showman in him, and he advertised products, and he owned businesses that had a lot to do with things that he was discovering as senator. For instance, when he worked toward, you know, getting fresh foods and et cetera, he opened a series of restaurants that served healthy food, and he had a laboratory that tested products. He had a famous newspaper column that he talked about health-related subjects, and the AMA got very upset with him, thinking that he was practicing medicine via his columns, which he really wasn't. But in time, he shepherded the 1938 FDA Act through Congress, and in it he snuck the homeopathic pharmacopoeia, which is why today anyone can go into a drugstore and get these remedies, for the most part, without a prescription. Now, do most of your listeners understand exactly what homeopathy is?
My guess is that they probably don't, so okay. I think it would be a good idea to talk about what it is.
Okay, because a lot of people confuse it just with the use of herbs, the full-strength herbs. Homeopathy does not use full-strength anything. It uses very dilute forms of minerals, herbs, plants, barks, animal products. And there are two, quote, rules, unquote, that one has to follow. The product, the dilute product, has to be like the symptoms the person is showing. For instance, if you had hay fever, you might get a tiny dose of dust or of any other product that would cause your hay fever. If you had an insect sting, you might get a very dilute dose of something made from a bee. The second rule is that it has to be the smallest possible dose. Sometimes the dilution is so small that there are no molecules left of the original substance, which leads a lot of the standard conventional doctors to call it the no medicine medicine.
And I guess one of the things that it's probably important to keep in mind to explain at least early on and perhaps all along why this kind of therapy has been so popular with people is that when it was developed in the late 1790s by this German physician, the state of medicine was rather crude. And we were at a time when there were still physicians who were bleeding people. And they were using drugs, they could be extremely powerful, and drugs where maybe their physiological reaction was poorly understood. And a lot of people, really, the idea of homeopathy appealed to people because it was much more gentle than other kinds of medical therapy.
Exactly. I mean, at the time in the late 1800s, in the late 1700s, rather, not only were what you just said going on, but people were poisoned with, mercury, all kinds of substances that, you know, pretty much either made them sicker and possibly brought them to death, which at that point they welcomed because they were so ill from this sickness to begin with, and then what was given to them to make them better didn't make them better. And then the bleeding, which was, very sharp, thin needles were put into probably 40 different parts of the body, and people were bled. Sometimes as much as 70% of the person's blood was taken out of them, and blistering went on. Even earlobes were blistered. So yes, when homeopathic remedies, which had no side effects to speak of, none indeed, were developed, and they were the final diluted product was put on a sugar capsule that was then, you know, put in the mouth and dissolved. I mean, that was bliss.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the fact that that all along one point of criticism of homeopathic medicine was this method of taking a substance that the practitioner thought would be beneficial and then diluting that so much so that by the end there might not actually even be any of the substance in the drug, however it was to be administered. And for that reason, physicians, scientists, you know, various people have looked at it and said, how could this possibly work when you don't even have any of the effective agent in there anymore? How did homeopathic practitioners respond to that kind of criticism, and how did they attempt to explain how it is that something like that could work?
Well, the first thing they did was they had a series of provings, and the provings were just a doctor giving this dilution to the patient and the patient getting better. So that proved on that particular patient it worked. So a series of these provings accumulated. It was all subjective, of course, the doctor and the patient, and then over time people just it grew that a certain medication worked for a certain illness. And over in Europe, very early, people began sort of testing these drugs. And then it wasn't really until the 1940s that clinical studies here in America became the gold standard for scientific research. And if I can just move far ahead into the present, 2005, modern homeopaths who not only are now beginning to use these clinical trials to test the drugs, but also the modern homeopaths have MD degrees. That's a whole other subject we can get into, which was a point of argument between the traditional doctors and the conventional doctors, the lack of a credentials, good education, and an MD degree. But anyway, to get back to the clinical studies, there's a group of young homeopaths that are now determined to test every single remedy, and there are thousands of them, and see what makes them work. And as one modern homeopath said to me, if it shows that it's the placebo effect, so be it. But at least we're going to finally prove what exactly happened.
We do have a couple of callers, and rather than make them wait, we will get right to them. And I should introduce again our guest, Natalie Robbins. She's the author of the book Copeland's Cure, Homeopathy and the War Between Conventional and Alternative Medicine. The book is published by Knopf, and it is, at least in part, a profile of a doctor named Royal Copeland, who was probably the best-known leading proponent of homeopathic medicine in the United States. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone to talk with on line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. I moved to call because of a piece on the radio concerning, of all things, alternative high school education. And the stress in the piece and the places they visited was on the, for our discussion, called a client-centered procedure. The kids in the high school, the parents of the kids, were actively involved in deciding curriculum, projects, work done, etc. It wasn't, as the article on the radio said, handed down by professionals to the uneducated. In that respect, how much of the current popularity of any sort of alternative medical treatment do you think is a result of client-centered direction, the people deciding for themselves what, where, how, and why, the sense that they are somewhat more in control of their care than has always been the case in the standard medical practice? So if you could direct the topic of people feeling more in control of their own care, I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for that point of view. Especially, just last week, I signed books at a health fair, and a woman came by where I was sitting and signing books, and she said, the older I get, the more I want to be in control of my medical situation, and the more I'm interested in alternative medicine. And so I said to her, but why can't you just have a talk with your regular conventional doctor and go back and forth about that? Why do you go just to alternative? And she said to me very simply, because I can go into the drugstore and buy them. And I think there's your answer. I think people are probably, want to regain control of their medical care. They feel left out in many ways because of the long waits and the insurance problems. And people have gone back to trying to take care of themselves. Everybody has a friend that, when you get a flu, says, oh, go try this particular medicine, and rather than call the doctor and find out what they should be doing.
I think that also in a point that, to bring us back to talking about homeopathic medicine and some of its features, you talked a little earlier about the fact that now you can go into a health food store, you may be able to go into a pharmacy and find a homeopathic remedy and buy that.
Yeah.
But I think this is something that a lot of homeopaths actually are kind of uncomfortable with, because in homeopathic medicine there is a basic principle that says that you tailor your therapy to the individual. And you might indeed have two individuals that had similar symptoms, but
yes.
then you might decide, even though they had similar symptoms, you would treat them differently. So it may be that someone who was a real homeopath would say, well, I'm not really all that comfortable with people treating themselves.
Yes, that's exactly true. Most of the modern homeopaths that I met at the meetings that I went to and the people that I interviewed agree exactly with what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And in addition, they also believe that you should have a traditional MD degree, because you might miss something. Somebody could come to you saying they have terrible headaches, and you go through the whole two-hour interview that homeopaths often give their patients to try to figure out every symptom. And if you don't have an MD degree, you might miss the symptoms for brain tumor.
Right. Let's talk with someone else. We have someone here on a cell phone and on line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I wanted to clarify something about the terminology of a homeopathic proving. My understanding was that a proving is where they give the full strength ingredient and note down what symptoms it produces. And then the assumption is that if you dilute it, it will then cure those symptoms, as opposed to a proving being, you know, you take the medicine and you got better. I think it's sort of one of the circular aspects of homeopathy that you know, you take this particular substance, it makes you sneeze, and then we all know that, of course, if you dilute it, it will cure your sneezing. And the provings are not showing that it works. They're showing that the full strength produces the symptoms.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you. No, mine is the opposite, that the proving shows that the right dilution, what you get to the right dilution and give it to the patient, and it solves the patient's problem. It's proof that that's the correct remedy to give them.
Maybe this is a question of terminology, because, of course, you do have to start with the full strength to find out what symptoms it produces so that you know, you know.
I don't think homeopaths give full strength at all.
Not for treatment, but to figure out which substances to use.
Yeah, but they were figured out 200 years ago, over 200 years ago. So most of the remedies that are in use today are the same ones that were proved 250 years ago.
Right, and it was those provings that determined that initial list. I had another question, too, though, which is whether you address or have considered sort of the consumer fraud aspects of homeopathy, where, you know, it's tremendously lucrative for a company to be able to put bottles on the shelf that list a whole bunch of ingredients, but in fact there aren't any of those ingredients in there, and they're able to produce them economically.
I go into that in great detail, and I pride myself on having written a very even-handed account, and because I think both sides on this issue tend to scream at one another, and my from the outset I was determined to write a book that told both sides of the story. And yes, I go into the people that consider it quacks, homeopaths quacks, and they speak their mind and the homeopaths answer. And I sort of leave it up to the reader to decide who's right.
I think it's important to distinguish between, say, herbal medicine or various other traditional and alternative medicines that can be very effective, mm-hmm. because they you know, they contain ingredients and they are. You take herbs, they do things to you. Some of them are dangerous, some of them are healthy.
Right.
As opposed to homeopathy, which is sort of in a class by itself.
Yes, that's quite true. And that's one of the reasons I picked it to write about, because it's so controversial. But I think after I finished the book, I came across an article by somebody I quote quite frequently in my book, a man named Stephen Barrett. He's a doctor who is in charge of a very interesting website called Quack Watch. And he wrote that quackery lies in the promise, not in the product. And I think that's a very wise statement.
Mm-hmm. I guess what irks me is the fact that there's bottles there with labels on them of, you know, exotic and expensive-sounding ingredients that sound like they would do something. But in fact, those ingredients simply aren't in the bottle.
Well, I think, there are a couple consumer groups now that people can subscribe to, and every month, they do a testing of various supplements, and it's my understanding that over time, I think there are two companies I mentioned in my book at the moment. I can't think of either of their name, but they're there. And over time, they intend to to test all these supplements and to figure out whether what's in the bottle is actually in the bottle.
Right. Although, of course, in the case of the homeopathic ones, that would be a failure. I mean, if it wasn't in the bottle, it would be defective.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the ones I wrote, one of these companies, I wrote them. They told me they were not planning to test homeopathic remedies per se, but they were going to test some of the main and full strength ingredients that certain remedies are made out of, which, of course, as you say, is not the same thing. So, again, it's a little hard to test homeopathic remedies.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
that way.
I thank the listener for the call. We got somebody else here I'd like to go on to, and this is a caller in Champaign, and it's line number one. So let's talk with them. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. I think the previous caller has a basic misunderstanding of how homeopathy works. the most potent or powerful remedies are in fact the ones that no longer have any molecules left, and the reason for that is that what is left is the vibrational energy, or if you will, energetic signature of the substance, and that energetic signature or substance kicks in or causes to the body to start its own healing abilities, and it's the body, turning on that self-healing mechanism, that homeopathy, that's how it works. So that, the less of the substance, the more energetic it actually is, and the more powerful. Does that go with your understanding of it?
Yes, except that one of the things I discovered in my research was that Samuel Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, said the smallest possible dose is the one that should be used, but he also said he didn't necessarily believe that the smallest dose was the one that would do the cure. That's one that a lot of modern homeopaths seem to have missed that message.
Mm. Well, the homeopaths that I've talked to, that's how they've explained it to me, is it's actually the vibrational energy that is left in the substance that is, what is effective, rather than the molecules. It's sort of a very different paradigm that they're working on than, say, herbal medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, again, I thank you for the call.
All right.
Let's go to our line number two. This is someone listening in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Great to hear the conversation. I had two quick comments. One, the previous caller mentioned the problems with mislabeling packages and products, ingredients not actually being in the bottle. That's not a problem with homeopathy. That's a problem with every industry. That's just simply false advertising, and to use that as an argument against homeopathy, I think, is spurious. It's not a correct kind of an argument to use, because every industry that has packaging has the same kind of problems. So I wanted to set that aside. The other one, though, my father is a veterinarian, and he has been using homeopathy and things like acupuncture now for years. And people who say, well, maybe the only reason this stuff works when it does work is the placebo effect, I think you'd have to go a long way to make the argument that a dog or a cat can experience the placebo effect. And I think that's an argument that sometimes people really forget to consider. But I just wanted to toss that in there. I think that there's a very good bit of evidence that this really works because it works, not just because of the placebo effect. So I just wanted to toss that in there.
Yes, okay. I think.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment that the phrase, this works because it works, is really a phrase that drives scientific medicine, traditional doctors, crazy, which is why modern homeopaths are now willing to go the route of the scientific medicine and do clinical studies of all the remedies, because it's just not good enough in 2005 to say it works because it works. We know too much about physics, medicine, the mind, the body, to say that. We have to be more specific, and I think we will be.
Well, I'm interested in maybe having you talk a little bit about one of the points that the caller made, and that is it seems that that Royal Copeland and perhaps other people who practice homeopathic medicine actually had some sort of they understood that perhaps there was something like the placebo effect going on, and that perhaps it was the case that some people got better because they believed that they would get better, and that they didn't necessarily view that as a problem or a weakness or a bad thing.
Exactly. That's quite true. And the other important thing to remember is that Royal Copeland and others like him, and I say others like him, that means homeopaths that had medical degrees, really thought of homeopathy as just one part of medicine. It wasn't the total way they approached all disease. It wasn't the only thing they did. They were willing to try homeopathy and all other means available at the time.
And I guess that's one of the things, one of the qualities perhaps Royal Copeland would share with contemporary homeopaths who are also MDs, who are also trained in allopathic medicine, is that he seemed to take that kind of pragmatic approach that said, let's look at any and all practices and see which of them may have some benefit.
Right.
And if they seem to have some benefit, why don't we use them?
Right, exactly.
Well, again, let's talk with somebody else. We have someone on a cell phone here, line number three. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, hi. It's not somebody else, the same one who was being rebutted by the one who calls back.
Okay.
The vibration theory, that was actually invented as an afterthought. The original dilution theory was proposed by Hahnemann before the atomic theory of matter was particularly well established, and he actually thought that there was sort of an infinitesimal but non-zero amount of the substance left. Once it became clear that, you know, that substances are made out of atoms that are indivisible and there weren't any of them left, then there was this kind of notion of vibrations as a backup plan to explain it. But, of course, you know, you have to think this kind of dilution happens in nature all the time. You wash something with water, there are repeated dilutions. If that kind of history, if where your water had been for the last couple of years mattered in its effects, you know, it would be dangerous to drink tap water. Imagine how many times that's been diluted in various different ways and various substances have left their signatures in it. I think that whole line of reasoning is, you know, if it were true, it would make the whole world very dangerous to be in, because you have to worry about where the, you know, the water you're drinking has been for its entire life. And it certainly is not sort of an explanation for how homeopathy works.
Hmm.
It's a set of words that they use to sort of justify it, but it's not a mechanism or a, you know, any kind of a means of functioning that could possibly be the case.
Right. Okay.
I just wanted to rebut that rebuttal of mine.
All right.
I'm aware of that theory.
And I don't know, again, if Ms. Robbins, and I want to make clear to anybody who's listening here that your book was not necessarily intended, was not intended at all as a defense of homeopathy.
No, it isn't. It's a history.
But as a history. So,
yes,
I mean, having said that, I don't know if there's, again, any way that you want to comment on
it. No, there's nothing. I mean, I can't comment. I mean, what I'm hearing is just the continuation of the argument that goes on and on and on and on, and will either be, you know, the argument will end when science prevails and homeopathy is proved to work or not.
Mm.
That's the way I see it.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Natalie Robbins. She is the author of 8 books, and the most recent is titled Copeland's Cure, Homeopathy and the War Between Conventional and Alternative Medicine. And as we explained at the beginning of the program, what she was interested in doing here is a history and looking at the kind of relationship between, or perhaps conflict between, conventional and alternative medicine over the years, looking specifically at one of the most controversial alternative kind of ways of practice, that's homeopathy. And also her book profiles an individual, really a very interesting man, a man named Royal Copeland, who was perhaps the best known champion of homeopathy here in the United States, who was a doctor who practiced homeopathy, also was involved in public health and in politics. And I think that one of the values of a book like this is to rescue characters, interesting characters like this, who have largely been forgotten, and introduce them again, to us. So if you're interested in the book, it's published by Knopf. It's out in the bookstore now, and questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to make sure that here we're already past our midpoint, that in addition simply just to debating the merits of homeopathy, that we talk about Royal Copeland. And as you give a very quick sketch of his life at the beginning, and I do think, as I said, one of the interesting things about a book like this is that it brings this character back, someone who at one point in America would have been well-known, perhaps a controversial figure, but now it has been largely forgotten, and it's a way of bringing back and saying, no, here was this man and what he did. And particularly, I think, interesting, his activities as a public health official in New York City at the time of the great flu pandemic in the 1918.
Yes, he did very unusual things at that point. He refused to close the movie theaters. He was asked to, but he said he thought the warmth of the theater would be, and to keep the patients or possible people that, you know, were close to people that had the flu, keep them warm was better than keeping them out of the theaters. And he had a corps of about, I think they were called, I can't remember their names, they weren't called security police, but they were policemen that went out looking for health problems in the shipyards, in the some of the tenements, and then would report rooms that were particularly overcrowded or places on the waterfront that had a particular accumulation of rodents that would, you know, cause a problem. And all these, his special policemen, I can't remember what he called them. It was an amusing name, actually. Again, helped keep things under control. And while, you know, thousands of people died in New York, not as many died as in some of the other cities around the country because of basically homeopathic measures that he used in terms of fresh air. He believed particularly in fresh air, which is something that the founder of homeopathy, Samuel Hahnemann, believed in, as well as exercise. And Copeland, I just wanted to make a point about him. In addition to being a character and doing remarkable things during the flu pandemic and then becoming the U.S. Senator from New York in 1923, he wrote books. He believed in keeping your weight down. He wrote a book particularly for women. He was enraged that women were overweight. Although he was an early feminist, nonetheless, his focus was on the weight of women. And he even, he himself took pictures of himself doing his exercises. He believed always that there was a way to help illness beyond just medicine too. He believed in exercise. He believed in fresh air. He believed in all the things that alternative medicine practitioners today say one should do before taking medicine. But most important, he also believed that you should take medicine. He believed in drinking water. In fact, he got into a lot of trouble. At one point, there was a water called Pluto water that he actually allowed his name and face to appear on in advertisements, and this was unheard of, that a senator's picture was on an advertisement like this. But what most people didn't know was that this particular water had 5 homeopathic remedies in it.
Hmm. I think that the name you were looking for, this group of policemen that he had going around doing investigating this, he called it the Sanitary Squad.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. A simple thing like that, and I forgot it. Sorry.
Obviously, the mainstream medicine community had grave concerns about homeopathy. They thought that it was not a legitimate approach, wanted to do what they can to get rid of it. Was he a particular target?
Yes, he was, and it's interesting because I think it was in around 1918 that the AMA started a file on Copeland. So really, they began to judge homeopathy by his behavior. So when they saw him in his advertisements, he advertised bread. He advertised not only this Pluto water. He advertised a form of a kind of mattress. He advertised a food store And nobody, I couldn't quite figure out why this particular food store interested him, but he said, you know, it's best to buy fresh foods there. And so when they saw, the AMA saw him, you know, hawking products, they really began to judge homeopathy by his character and behavior, and, you know, saw that his show, him being a showman, probably proved that homeopathy was also the kind of medicine that should be sold in a carnival rather than in a drugstore.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that if you take a look at some of the things he believed about health is, well, you might indeed have your problems with homeopathic medicine. You might say, well, that's it's bunk. That at the same time, a lot of the other things that he believed about what contributed generally to people's health seemed pretty well to be on target, and we're continuing to tell people the same things today.
Right. Well, there, you know, there was a time in the early part of the 1900s that people believed that the electric light had wonderfully healing facilities, mm-hmm. and you know, people would have electric everything, electric girdles, electric wires around their hands, throats, every place, thinking that that was going to have curative powers. And Copeland also believed that a certain kind of electric light, you know, might help an eye problem. So, I mean, this, he was also a product of his times. People were experimenting. Don't forget, this was before, way before, really, aspirin. This was before, way before antibiotics. It was after, of course, we knew germs caused disease. So people were, you know, still searching for ways to... we had vaccines, vitamins eventually came in, and then eventually aspirin, and then sulfa, and then penicillin. And then in the mid-40s, people clamored for, you know, penicillin the way they did homeopathic remedies. But by that time, 1940, Royal Copeland actually died in 1938 for the reason that he was so busy taking care of the country that he didn't take care of himself, so it was said. But he probably would have agreed that he would not have been opposed to the use of antibiotics. He would have then used homeopathy as in a complementary form, the word that has now, you know, come into vogue more than alternative.
Yeah.
And I think more and more alternative medicine is called complementary medicine, or should be, and standard doctors are willing to let their patients use both.
I think that that's an important point. I tried to make that at the beginning when I was, I hope not painting too broad a brush, where I talked about the mainstream medical community at least viewing alternatives with a healthy dose of skepticism.
Yeah.
Having said that, at the same time, that there are many conventionally trained physicians that are very open to the idea of alternatives as an adjunct or an add-on to conventional treatment. And I think that many physicians they're willing to be persuaded that alternatives could have some benefit.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's especially going to be true as more and more, well, homeopathy is the one I know about the best because that's when I studied, but as the homeopathic remedies are subject to the clinical trials and things show why they work, more and more doctors might, standard doctors that is, might add them to the cocktail of drugs that they give their patients.
Yeah. And you make the point, as you just did, that homeopathy was quite popular in the United States right up through the 1930s, and that perhaps what happened would to contribute to its decline in popularity is that mainstream medicine seemed to have more to offer that was effective, and people were interested in what seemed to be the cutting edge of the time.
Right.
Having said that, though, interestingly enough, homeopathy seems to have made something of a comeback within the last few decades, maybe starting in the 1960s.
And I think it started in the 60s when all the boundaries were once again challenged and people once again sought unconventional means of everything. And so they once again looked for unconventional medicines and therefore they looked toward homeopathy. And that's continued in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And I think now there's a similar reason people are less going to homeopathic doctors and more just going into their pharmacy, at least from the people that I've talked to when I've given book talks around the country, mm-hmm. that because they're just tired of waiting for their doctor's appointments, and they consider, well, I've got nothing to lose because these remedies are painless. These remedies don't really have full dose anything in it, so let's give it a chance while I'm waiting for my doctor.
Yeah, we and just maybe one further point about the that I would have you talk a little bit more sure. about the career of Royal Copeland. We made the point
yes.
that he was a physician. He was the commissioner yes. of health in New York City at a very difficult time when the flu pandemic was going on in 1918, and he also was in the Senate, the United States Senate from
yes.
New York, and at that time really helped to move through the Congress the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938. And
yes.
interestingly enough, he managed to, as you said, he managed to slip homeopathy in there.
Yes, and it's one of the surprises in writing my book was that most homeopaths thought he was a turncoat and had turned against homeopathy quite early in his career when, in fact, it was always in his was in the front of his mind, but in the back pocket was to do something for it. And when he was in the Senate, he finally found his chance to do something for it when he put the homeopathic pharmacopoeia into that bill. And he once said that when he was dying, he always would want his standard doctor near his side and his homeopathic doctor. And indeed, that's what happened. As he was dying, the June that his bill was passed in 1938, the doctor from the Senate was by his side and his homeopathic doctor was also, and I might add that he had a very illustrious career in the Senate beyond this bill that he was so famous for. He would always be counted on to do all kinds of legwork, and he was in the Immigration Committee. He was on he helped with the parks in New York State. He worked extremely hard to get a lot of stuff done, and he could always be counted on to do things. And he was, in fact, one of the few senators that had his hours posted on his door.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Natalie Robbins. Her book is Copeland's Cure, Homeopathy and the War Between Conventional and Alternative Medicine. Knopf is the publisher. It's intended to be kind of a history looking at that conflict between conventional and alternative medicine, looking specifically at one, perhaps the most controversial alternative health practice, and that is homeopathy. And the book profiles this man we've talked about, Royal Copeland, who was at one time the sort of the leading proponent or spokesperson for homeopathy here in the United States. We have a number of calls, more than I'm sure that we can get in, but we'll try to get in at least a couple in the time that remains in the order they came in here. So we'll go to Aurora first, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My story starts a long time ago with a Cairn Terrier I had that had skin problems continuously. And the doctor would give him medications, and finally the dog died, not from the medications. His skin, his coat was beautiful when he died, and I looked at it and lamented, and I thought to myself, I wouldn't have used those meds if I would have known what they were going to do to my dogs, to kill my dog, really. In fact, they did. They ruined his kidneys, and he died from kidney problems with a beautiful coat. So with that in mind, all my life, I have lessened my taking a medication, and recently when I was going through a lot of stress, my doctor wanted me to take high blood pressure medication, and I thought about it, and I said, you know, I'm going to find out what causes high blood pressure, although I knew some of them, you know, stress. So I lessened my salt, which I always had. I didn't drink coffee. I got into calming activities instead of stressful ones, walked away from the stressful ones, and I brought my blood pressure down from 170 over 58 to 98 over 58. And I just thought, I was kind of angry at my doctor. I thought, why didn't he suggest some of these things? He never told me to not drink coffee, to lessen salt, etc. He didn't say any of that. He just gave me these medications. So my next appointment was 3 months later, and I told him what I did. I said, I'm not going to take these medications. And so we discussed it, And he said, well, maybe you could take them once a week or twice a week in stressful situations. And I thought, yes, I could do that. And so that's what I, in fact, am doing. And I walked out of the office thinking I never thought the day would come when I would negotiate my own health care plan.
I think that's health care in 2005. I think more patients should do that, and more patients are doing that. Because this is a completely off the subject of Royal Copeland and homeopathy, but it's just something I happen to be interested in, so if you don't mind that comment on it.
Sure, yeah.
Which is that the age of paternal medicine is over, and I think patients are co-patients with their doctors and should be, and that's the best way to get medical care. And I think the best doctors agree with that. I know my own doctors in my life, you know, expect me to speak up and know a lot about the things that are wrong with me and the things I should do. But I think, you know, you have to think of your doctor as the expert, though, even though you're the you're a co-doctor or a co-patient with the with your doctor. He or she is still the expert, because you haven't gone to medical school.
Right. Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. And I think, as you say, Ms. Robbins, that what this kind of gives you an illustration of how it is that at least some people now are thinking about their approach to health care, wanting to be active participants.
Yes.
And that does certainly connect with the popularity of alternative medicine, because it again has a lot to do with people's feeling that they're involved themselves, that they're making some decisions, that indeed it says something about how the relationship between doctor and patient has changed.
Yes.
Let's talk again with someone else. This is Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Line number two?
Yes.
Oh, hi. about a month ago, I read a review of alternative medicine books, and that's sort of the history of that. And one of the reviewers said something real interesting in there. He said to the effect that if alternative medicine really worked, it wouldn't be alternative. And I thought that was sort of a poignant analysis of the situation, that people that see alternative medicine now, alternative to what you call traditional medicine, probably, you know, if it did work, it wouldn't be alternative. So that's all I have to say about it. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I don't know, Ms. Robbins, how do you react to a statement like that?
Well, I react to it in a specific way. If you're talking about, for instance, cancer treatments, I would agree with that statement, because there is no alternative cancer treatment that can cure cancer. And if there were, it would be heralded on every headline of every newspaper in the country. But in terms of an alternative treatment, say, like acupuncture, that could help certain. That's been shown, and so many conventional doctors, you know, tell their patients to try it for certain kinds of pain. So, again, we go back to maybe using that word complementary. There are certain kinds of medicines that can probably complement standard medicine.
Yeah. And I think, again, as I have a couple times, I just want to make sure people understand the kind of focus that you have in the book, that it is intended to be a history and not a promotion of alternative medicine,
exactly.
Not a condemnation of alternative medicine,
yeah.
Not a, you know, it's not something. And I was very interested in some material that came with the book when you attempted to do research at the AMA and also research with the homeopathic community. Everybody wanted to know what you felt.
Yes.
They wanted to know, are you for us or are you against us?
That's quite true. That's quite true. I was quite startled by that. And in fact, at the AMA, I have not heard from the AMA about what they think of my book, and I was quite curious about that, although the homeopaths I've heard from, and I think they're so pleased that I gave them took an even-handed approach, that that's why they're pleased with the book. But getting back to your point about my whole point is to show that, to instruct by reading history. And in fact, I wrote a little essay. I don't know whether it came with the stuff that you have about my book. It was called What I Learned from Writing and Reading My Book, because I found out that most people, as I can tell from your callers too, they want a manual, which I don't give them. I just give them the history, and then they have to figure it out for themselves.
Mm-hmm. other things that you, and unfortunately I didn't get the piece
what
that
I
you
learned
mentioned, what I learned from any book. At least I'm not sure that I have. What other sorts of things do you feel that you learned from writing the book?
Well, I'm going to just read you the last paragraph of what I learned from writing and reading. I said, so, let's see, where did I say that? One, use an MD. Make sure he or she is fully licensed. Use remedies that have been tested in clinical studies and read history. It informs us about the past and can present a total picture that can help us make wiser, more interesting decisions in the future.
Hmm. And not, I don't want to be giving out a lot of information about you, but I guess one of the things that I know about you is that indeed you are a cancer survivor, and certainly your first line of attack, it sounds like, was conventional medicine.
Oh, absolutely. I'm alive today because of two chemotherapy drugs, one called fludarabine and one called Rituxan. And I think, in a way, I mean, people have also asked me how, you know, when standard medicine has kept your cancer in remission for so long, you know, how can you write about alternative medicine as you do? And the answer is that it's in my nature to explore as many possibilities that exist in all subjects, and I want to see both sides of any situation.
Hmm. Well, if there are other people who are interested in that, you should look at the book that we have talked about. Once again, the title of the book is Copeland's Cure, and the subtitle is Homeopathy and the War Between Conventional and Alternative Medicine. It's published by Knopf by our guest Natalie Robbins. And Ms. Robbins, I want to say thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Sinfonia de Camera, presenting an evening of romance featuring pianist Ian Hobson, 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, April 30th, in the Follinger Great Hall at the Kranitz Center for the Performing Arts. The performance will include Schumann's Piano Concerto in A Minor and Serenade No. 1 by Brahms. For more information, call 333-6280. Today's broadcast also made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater. Information on the full line of Subaru is available from Paul Moser or Kelly Wetherill, certified Subaru specialist. Their email address is subaru@wardenmartin.com. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There'll be much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with historian Douglas Flaming. He is the author of Bound for Freedom, Black Los Angeles in Jim Crow America. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look now at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade and Merck. May wheat trading at 323 and a quarter, up 2.5. July, 333, up 2.5. May corn, 212 and a half, down 3 quarters. July corn, 221 and a quarter, down 1. September, 228 and 3 quarters, down 1 quarter. December, 237 and a half, up 1 quarter. May beans, 635 and a half, up 1 quarter. July, 642 and a quarter, up 1 quarter. November beans, 629 and a half, that down 1 quarter. May meal, 199.80, down 20. May soybean oil, 22.66, down 20.